Get ready to expand your horizons and discover great reads. This is Bookbound, a library podcast. Welcome back to Bookbound. I'm Jessica Trotter. I'm joined at the mic by Mari Garza and Cheryl Lindemann, and we are your cattle selectors. Hey, ladies.
Hello.
That was a tune.
Let's try that again.
So we're recording this at the beginning of June. It's Pride Month. It's Audiobook Month. We've got little bits of both of those and other stuff too. So I want to just dig right in.
Absolutely. Well, I have a great read, I think, for any time of year, but especially for summer in Michigan, in the Midwest, when I feel like I finally can get outside, depending on, you know, what's going on. There's some other factors we've been talking about, you know, like
smoke,
air quality, alerts, and that sort of thing. But this book is a second book by the author Bonnie Swee. Her first one was Why We Swim, and I did talk about that on the podcast, I believe in 2000 when it came out. Yep. And this one is on muscle, the stuff that moves us and why it matters. Again, a perfect book for summer because the takeaway from this for me was I felt much more motivated to get out and like build some muscle. Yeah. I mean, not necessarily in a bodybuilder way, although that is touched on in here. The first woman to raise the Dinny Stones, the Scottish, those stones is in here. So there's bodybuilders. Bonnie Swee is just a master at the nonfiction genre because she blends a thread of something personal through science facts, through really fascinating stories. She travels all around. This one goes into the personal story is about her and her father and how when she was a child, she and her brother were encouraged to make a muscle. And he always focused on being strong and being athletic and why. And through the book, she threads how the ways we talk about muscle are also the ways we talk about life and the parallels between strength and life. But she talks about a paralyzed person who is a champion of yoga and about how the neuroscience of how somebody who is paralyzed, if they go through certain yoga movements, their brain will actually turn on as if they're doing them. There is a story of an indigenous community that does a 50-mile run in honor of a boy who ran away from boarding school, Indian boarding school, two times. And that run is done in honor of him. So this book just travels lots of terrain and really inspires about movement and about life. She also has a father-in-law with ALS. So that story is threaded through. So an inspiring read, really a quick read, and one that gets you wanting to do whatever movement you could do.
Interesting.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, I have the next book. This is Mari, and I have At Last She Stood, How Joey Guerrero Spied, Survived, and Fought for Freedom. And this is by Erin Estrada Kelly, two-time Newbery winner, really an amazing writer. I did not know this, but Erin actually got her start in journalism. So this is a nonfiction work about Joey Guerrero or Josefina Guerrero, who was a Filipina woman born in 1917. And during the war, the Second World War in the Pacific side or in the Philippines, the Japanese came to her community in Manila and kind of took over. I personally don't know that side of World War II history very well, so this was really interesting for me to read about how the Japanese kind of took over the city and how you know the American troops or bases had to kind of evacuate a bit. But she had a condition. Some people still call it leprosy, but it's really Hansen's disease. And this is a disease that I grew up thinking was, you know, like this ancient disease that no longer exists, you know, in today's world. But it's a skin disease that erupts with, I will just say goo or, you know, causes a lot of itchiness, but it's also very disfiguring. It is not as contagious as some people really thought it was, but it is contagious to some degree. So back in the day, there were leper colonies, and maybe there still are communities where people with this disease, Hansen's disease, still live together. But Josie or Joey developed this disease and had to kind of separate from her family, her husband and her daughter, and was living in an area where the Japanese, you know, kind of basically told you what you had to do. And she became a spy to help the Americans and the guerrillas who were trying to, the communities, you know, the underground rebels, I guess you could say, trying to fight against the Japanese. And she at one point, like, strapped a map to her back and padded it with something. And because of her disfigurement, when she came across Japanese soldiers, they did not want to, like, be near her. And she received a Medal of Freedom, was awarded a Medal of Freedom later on, and just eventually came to the United States to get treatment in a place called Carsville, which is a community where Hansen's disease persons lived. In Louisiana, I think it was. But just a really fascinating book. And throughout the book, there's just lots of interesting, just little, you know, snippets of history, maps, photographs. On page 118, there's a really interesting, you see the progression of someone who comes into Carsville and then starts to get treatment and how her skin and her disfigurement goes away. I don't think it's of Joey, but it's a really neat photograph.
That's very interesting. Yeah. Okay, so my first book is the one I kind of want to gush over. This is The Book of Alchemy by Suleika Jaoud. Jaoud credits journaling with saving her life when she was at some of her lowest points, when she was diagnosed with leukemia at the age of 22. You may have heard of her, well, I'm hoping many of you have heard of her. She's a best-selling author of Between Two Kingdoms, which is kind of about her cancer journey. She is married to Joan Baptiste, and they travel and perform together. And this book is she in 2020 kind of looked around and saw people trying to figure out what to do and what, you know, how to get through the time and how to get through hard time period. And she created, she fostered an online community challenging people to journal for 100 days. And this book sort of comes out of that. It's for anyone interested in, and she, I love the way she puts this, in returning to that uninhibited sense of play that we have as children. It's journaling as meditation, exploration, and just also as fun. It's a collection of about 110 essays. So there's, she has 10 at the start of each, one at the start of each of the chapters or sections. And then there are 100 journaling prompts, and they're all over the place. They're things that will make you think. They're things that will make you laugh. They're from a wide range of people, people she met in her cancer journey, people she has met in life, people she met online through the community. But it includes her husband, John Batiste. It includes Danny Shapiro, Keith Lehman, Gloria Steinem, John Green, Elizabeth Gilbert, Mavis Staples, Haneef Adurakib, Ann Patchett, George Sanders, Salman Rushdie. That's just a few, I mean, of the 100 people. And it's just a really fabulous collection of essays, and then followed essays that can be as much as a paragraph or a few lines to it, but everything ends with a really neat writing prompt. You can take it in chunks. You can work through it over 100 days like people did with the online community. You can run with one of them over and over again. Some of them are things that you could just, you could see the difference every day in, with just this one writing prompt. But it's just fast. It's one of those things where I just wish I had more time. Because they're really interesting. I will say, I listened to a good chunk of this, and it's a wonderful audiobook. Again, something you can sort of take in chunks, because it is, some of these things are very short. Some of the lead-ins are very short. But it's just a... It just gets you thinking. If there's somebody who's interested in writing, I would suggest this. If there's somebody who's just looking for a different way of approaching meditation or just ideas of how to process your day, it's really interesting.
Sounds wonderful. Well, and it's a beautiful book.
It is a beautiful book.
It's got like this marble swirling.
Mm-hmm.
It's just lovely.
Okay. So we actually asked, it's like I said, it's audiobook month. And we posted on Facebook asking people how they listened. We, whether it's through our services like Libby and Hoopla or Spotify or Audible or books on CD, or maybe you don't at all. We got a lot of responses. It was quite fascinating. About 80% of you, and there's overlap. A lot of people used everything, anything that they could. Mm-hmm. But about 80% used Libby, which was fun for me since I order a lot of that stuff. 51% used Hoopla 2 or Hoopla. About 11% used Audible. And there was still like 7% that actually used books on CD.
Long live the car CD player.
I mean,
yeah.
The interesting thing is it's harder and harder to get books on CD for us as a library. It's surprising to me what isn't coming out on book on CD, but I understand it's not a lot of use on what we buy. So it's, but definitely there for Libby and Hoopla. It's really obvious. And it's a good chunk of our ebook budget goes to that. And we also had, you know, a group of people who say, there was a few people that said, nope, can't do audiobooks at all. Somebody said, my mind wanders, I can't do audiobooks. Somebody else said, I can't do audiobooks, I can't do ebooks. If there's not a page that I'm turning, it's not reading for me. It's different for everybody. I totally get that. I definitely do audio. I do a lot of audio in the car. I do mostly Libby. And it's, if you're at all wonder how kind of that works out, Libby and Hoopla are, Libby is something where we can actively pick what goes into the collection and purchase. But Hoopla is something where they have what they have. And it's an open catalog, and that's every time somebody checks something out, that's how we end up paying for it, is on the checkouts. So it's, they're two, what's the word that I'm looking for? They're complementary. Sometimes there are things that are the same in them. The plus always to Hoopla is that if it's there, you can download it right now. The plus to Libby is that it has a broader collection of what people are looking for usually.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting thing to watch. And I just love that everybody is reading. That's the goal for me. Wherever you're reading, just read.
Yes. I can't tell you how many people have told me people like to confess to librarians.
They do. They really do.
They'll be like, I love everything, but I don't really read anymore so much. I listen to my books. I'm like, that's fine. There's absolutely you and a lot of other people, as we're seeing every year, our digital demand goes up for audiobooks. I mean, it's so easy. You can do it in the car. You can listen while you're doing other things. Have people had say that they were, you know, like cooking, that sort of thing, cleaning, walking around the house, whatever they're doing to, you know, so it's so portable. It's
mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's
really wonderful. It reminds me a lot of, like, you know, when you're reading to children. I remember reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe to my nieces and nephews, and they were just spellbound. And it's like, that's how it is when I'm in the car and you're listening to a really good story. You know, you're just like, ooh.
Yeah.
And I know there are reasons people say that audiobook listening isn't reading, but it is. You are still getting, it may be a slightly different value, but you are definitely getting language value in an audiobook.
You're consuming a book.
Yes.
That being said, I tend to listen less. I don't have as much time to listen in the car, and that's the only place I do listen. And there are a lot of things I don't want to listen to, or I start it and I'm like, oh, I want to read this.
Yep.
And so that's just me. You know, I think everybody comes to this differently.
Yes.
I have been utilizing it in a way to get to some books that have been on my TBR that I had never got to. And so for me, one of the books that year was The Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath. I couldn't turn around when I was younger without someone telling me it was their favorite book and that sort of thing. And I had just never read it. So I listened to it, and it was Maggie Gyllenhaal actually read it. It was just really interesting. So I'm really glad I read it. I have to say that was really kind of an experience, especially hearing it. Mm-hmm. I'm really more interested in Sylvia Plath, and I've been doing like a deep dive on the side about her. But that also drew me to just my own TBR of classics, which brought me to The Heart is a Lonely Hunter by Carson McCullers. Another book where so many people said, this is my favorite book. This is my favorite book. And I actually tried it when I was younger, and I wasn't ready for it or something. I picked this up and read this year, and I'm not going to talk at depth about it, but I do want to encourage listeners, if you're interested in Southern Gothic, if you're interested in stories that really capture a really difficult time in American history, the South in the 1930s in a small, mill town. It's kind of a savage book. The title is perfect for what it captures. And what coming away from this book, I was really moved by it. I will never forget it. And I want to know more about Carson McCullers, the author. That's what made me think. So it brought me to a book that came out in 2020. And it came out at a time, literally the New York Times article about this book was February 2020. So those books that came out at that time were buried in March of 2020. Absolutely. And pretty much all of 2020 publishing is sort of sad. We had to discard books that, some of them that just didn't ever gained any traction. Well, this was a title that did still get some awards. It's called My Autobiography of Carson McCullers, a memoir by Jen Shapland. It was a National Book Award finalist. It was a Lambda Literary Award for lesbian memoir. It was longlisted for the Andrew Carnegie Medal. So it did get picked up by different people who found it. But I found this really fascinating because it's one of those books that form-wise is really creative. It's little vignettes, little pieces. It doesn't have that really clear structure, which again, some people might not like that at all. Also, if people are coming to this book like, okay, I want a biography of Carson McCullers, this is not it. In fact, what it's doing is more examining what does biography do? And in the case of Carson McCullers, even her autobiography that she did do and her works about her, there's so much erasure in her real life, not only her sexual identity as a lesbian, but also about the real way her father died. I mean, there's a lot that was sort of glossed over. And she examines, what does biography do? You take what you can find, source materials, and that the biographer is really crafting a story. Mm-hmm. And over the years, how much has been left out? How many, especially queer people's stories have been changed or altered? Women who had a roommate, a lifelong roommate, or a traveling companion, or her friend, that sort of thing. And that's pulled out in here. But there's a little bit of a mystery. There's an example. The Jen Shapland goes, and she's an intern in archives. It's the Henry Ransom Center at University of Texas Austin. And most of the questions are people wanting information about Norman Mailer or David Foster Wallace, which is not surprising. But she stumbles upon some love letters from Anne Marie Clerk Schwarzenbach to Carson McCullers. And these are love letters. And she goes, okay, what is this? At this time, she hasn't read any Carson McCullers herself. She's heard The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. I mean, in some ways, who hasn't to some degree? So she thinks, okay, what is this? I want to know more. So this is truly at its heart a memoir of Jen Shapland about her coming into her really embracing her identity as a lesbian. And it becomes the story of her diving into archives, living in Carson McCullers' house. Carson McCullers' clothing is still in the closets. Her pictures are on the walls. And it's about her kind of unraveling her own young adult identity through the story in a way of learning about Carson McCullers and how her identity was sort of hidden or massaged or changed over the years. So it's a really, really wonderful book. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was riveted. I couldn't really put it down. And I like this type of book. Again, some people narrative style wise may be like, what was this I was looking for? And it's not going to be the book for you. If it's the book for you, it will be. And you'll know when you pick it up. But I really highly recommended it. And I'm still on the hunt for more about Carson McCullers. So yeah. And also to encourage the listeners to read The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. It's a bit of a gut punch, but it's it's really a beautiful and I think really important work.
Okay. So my next book, actually, Cheryl and I were kind of talking in the 60s we're in. as a setting, kind of internationally. So I say that because my book is The Cafe with No Name by Robert Zitoller, who is Austrian. And this is an English translation from Europa. This is essentially the life of a working class Viennese cafe, and its owner and its patrons. It's a large cast, but a tiny book, actually. It's under 200 pages. I listened to most of it. It is just an interesting view into a community. We're talking Austria, post-World War II. Robert was orphaned, grew up in an orphanage, kind of signs himself out as soon as he is able to go out and work. He doesn't actually finish all of school. I think he leaves school at 16, starts working in factories, ends up getting work doing kind of odd jobs for his local market. So he's a fix-it person. It helps the different vendors. But he somewhere along the way finds, like, he goes into a pub and kind of thinks that this is something I want to do. So he creates a cafe. He's like just early 30s. I think he's 31. In 1966, he opens this cafe. He doesn't have a name for it. It never really gets a name. It's the Cafe with No Name. But it's the people that come through. It's him just sort of finding his feet to the cafe, hiring his first waitress. It's found family. There's always the butcher. The local butcher is a patron, is actually the person who's there. It kind of talks him into hiring the waitress. Strange things happen, but you just are getting a really interesting view of the time. And it goes up, it closes in, I want to say, the mid-80s. So it's come like 20 years in the life of this cafe and the comings and goings in vignettes. And it's a wonderful audiobook, but it also has these weird, interesting interludes. It almost makes more sense in the audiobook, but you can read it this way and understand. Once you see what's happening, you get to a chapter that is just a block of text, no paragraph breaks. And what it is you're overhearing kind of firsthand the conversation of the day. And sometimes it's giving you a little bit of a background about characters you've heard about earlier in the book. Sometimes it's just giving you some setting of what's happening in the world as this is all happening. It's like nonstop, back and forth, and every once in a while a turn to the waitress who's delivering the drinks, and then back to the gossip of what's going on. And it was just well put together, interesting peek into the time.
Okay, so I have a question. Mm-hmm. You talked it up so much yesterday as we were talking about what we were going to talk about on the podcast that I started listening to it. Is it somewhat biographical by Robert? Because you referred to him, Robert. I thought his name was Simone in the story. Simone?
It's Robert Simone.
It's
Robert Simone.
Okay.
Robert Simone.
Okay. And that's the author.
Yes,
too.
And the author's name is Robert Zitoller.
Zitoller, okay.
Yes. And
okay.
I looked into him a little bit. This was first read for me. And I did have that passing thought. He's actually an author and actor in Austria.
I highly recommend. I'm only like 10% in, but yeah.
It's just a neat way of doing it. I just thought it was I don't know if the cover pulled me in. It reminded me very much of, in style, it reminds me very much of Daniel Lavery's Women's Hotel, in terms of the vignettes of a place.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, I have some picture books I want to talk about. The first one is actually a nonfiction picture book. Are You a Friend of Dorothy? The True Story of an Imaginary Woman and the Real People She Helped. And this is by Kyle Lukoff, illustrated by Levi Hastings. And yes, I talked about Kyle Lukoff, I think, last month.
That's okay.
I'm sorry you got mad, but I really like this author. So this book stood out to me because it's a piece of history.
Absolutely.
Which relates to, you know, the LGBT community a while ago has and still had and still has a distinct form of discrimination that is issued by our communities, right, all around our country and across the world. But there used to be, you know, this phrase that people would say, are you a friend of Dorothy? And I admit that, like, even 5-10 years ago, I would have thought that this person was a real person. But it turns out that Dorothy was fictional. This was a coded phrase that many in the LGBTQ plus community would say to find their own people, their own community. They're wanting to know if you're with me, you're for me. So it was a coded phrase that, again, I didn't know about until a few years ago. But it's just fascinating the work that Kyle does and just expressing how people would use this phrase. How even the military at some point started investigating, who is this Dorothy person? And, you know, just interesting things. It's about 40 pages long. I think it's a really great read for children interested and parents interested in the history of the LGBTQ community.
Does it go into the Wizard of Oz at all?
The Wizard of Oz.
It comes from the Wizard of Oz.
Yes, it does, actually. Okay. You're right. It's at the back, at the end. Excellent. There's, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
It's a, if you're rewatching it in a queer context, it's very clear. It feels like it was made for gay people. Like, I love the Wizard of Oz. Mm-hmm. It reads very, like, subliminally queer. Mm-hmm. And just, like, all of the characters that go along with Dorothy, they're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like, you're one of us. So
yes.
Dorothy.
Yeah.
That's such a wonderful thing.
Yeah, I didn't read it through that lens, but there is reference to that in the book. The other book I have is You and Me, Anemone. This is by Rachel Vale, and it's illustrated, or really the artwork is by Chris Rashka. This is an amazing, just beautiful book in seeing it, but also in reading it. It's really a book about personal space, I think, encouraging children to advocate for themselves when, you know, people touch you or get too close to you, to speak up and say, back up, please, or, you know, please don't touch me. But the story is set, you know, if you see anemone is a polyp, something in the waters that, you know, kind of grows out. It looks like a flower. It's not a flower. It's a creature. And if you were to touch it, it just, like, shrinks up and, you know, kind of gets into itself. And this book is a bit of a tongue twister as well, which I really liked. I'm just going to read a couple of lines. I'm a sea anemone, a lemony anemone, an anonymous anemone. But you could be a friend to me. So it's just the artwork is beautiful in that Rashka puts, like, it's sort of like embroidery, maybe. I'm not quite sure it's embroidery, but there's like a burlap background, and he stitched all these images. It's just beautiful. I really liked this book. Really encouraging, you know, using that look of an anemone and, like, how they also want their personal space. And you can just say that quietly, like, I please don't touch me, please.
Mm-hmm. It's great.
Yes, it is.
Chris Rashka, so wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So my last book actually goes back to Pride again. So this is very new. This is The Lilac People by Milo Todd. It is a really intense look at the vibrant and trans LGBT community of Weimar, Germany, in Berlin. It's the home of the Institute of Sexual Sciences. It was a place where early place for gender-affirming surgery, care, therapy. They worked with the broad range of the LGBT community. The characters in this book, the primary character, Bertie, is a trans man who works for the Institute, is assistant to Dr. Hirschfeld. And I'm good. Am I saying that right? I apologize. Oh, yep. Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld. And so this is a book set in two timelines. It's set both pre and into the rise of Hitler and the Third Reich. And then also it actually opens in 1945, just after the freedom of Dachau. However, what they realize very quickly, because somebody escapes and makes it basically to their farm, is that freedom isn't freedom for the LGBT community. They're going to be put back in prisons for being who they are. So they are kind of on a quick timetable to figure out what to do next, because they need to get out of where they are, had been safely hiding through the war. Mm-hmm. So you've got both the story going into the war and the story of kind of escaping the aftermath of the war, and just trying to find a place to be. So it's really moving, really kind of hard, but beautifully done. So that's The Lilac People by Milo Todd. Very. It's rather scarily timely.
Yeah.
So.
And this nonfiction book about Institute, right? About
yep. The actually, there is about Magnus Hirschfeld that came out this last month.
And quite a few books recently about Weimar Germany, too, that have been on my TBR and had to get returned and that kind of thing. But about.
It's a long, long list. Yes. Yeah, exactly.
So, to something totally different, but possibly slightly related. How interesting that is, only in the time period.
Yes.
The time period in history. This book is a little bit older now. It's 2019. It began with a page, how Gyo Fujikawa Drew the Way by Kyo MacLear. And Kyo MacLear is an author that Jessica talked about. She wrote a book called Unearthing, and it was on our best books a couple of years ago, sort of a genealogy, family history, also involving plants and a mother with Alzheimer's and that sort of thing. And the illustrator on this is Julie Morstad. And I think I talked about Julie Morstad a few months ago, and we talked about Hope and Joy. Her illustrations just bring that to me. But this was really interesting to me because I swear Madi must have mentioned this book to me, because I love Gyo Fujikawa. I talked last podcast about how I didn't have many kids' books, but I did have some books illustrated by Gyo Fujikawa. And I brought some that I actually had, little board books I'd bought for my
teeny
daughter.
Tiny board books.
Yeah. And they're like these little teeny, adorable, teeny, precious, round-headed children. But this is the story of Gyo and her journey as an artist. She lived 90 years. She was born in 1908 in California. And this story includes the internment of her family, includes her work at Disney as one of the early people working on some of the projects in animation. There was crossover. Yep.
Yep, exactly.
It's just this beautifully illustrated story of her life. And of course, the pinnacle is when she writes the first book, Babies, and brings it to the publisher in the 1960s. And she's been working on these drawings really her whole life. And this is the way she wanted to see books with not just white children in them. And so she brings.
Fancy that. I mean, really?
She brought, I believe it was Crossett and Dunlap. She brought to the publisher and they're like, oh, it's wonderful. But yeah, this isn't going to sell in the South. So we don't really want to do this. And she's like, well, I want you to. Okay. And they waited and they did. And this book and her other one about baby animals, I think also includes many children, always diverse characters in the stories. Over 2 million copies of his books have sold. They reached me in the 1980s as a little child. Wow. And so they're still going. We have them in the collection. I'll link to the show notes. but she really fought for the rights of authors and illustrators. She continued with advocacy throughout her life, and she was a beloved. I like this too. It ties into some of the other books. She was a. She did not have children of her own. She did not get married. She was a beloved auntie to her to her nieces and nephews, and just lived a life that she wanted to lead and achieve the things that she wanted to do, and really made a big difference in children's publishing.
Yeah. So. For sure.
I didn't know that reading these as a little kid. I just loved the picture so much. Mm-hmm. These little round-headed children. They're so precious. You know, and just to think. So, yeah.
That's so cool. Like, I they went over all of that in that giant animation book.
It's so cool. So
they went super in-depth into all of these different, like, female artists and just highlighting that diversity and the their commitment to diversity just and why, you know, the white guys that ran animation studios weren't always that into that. So it's really cool to see that being highlighted in a bunch of different ways.
Yeah, it really is.
Shows why diversity is so important.
Yes.
It is.
Well, I have the last book, Oasis by Kyujing. This is probably one of the most interesting books I have read in the last week. It's a graphic novel. It is a kid's graphic novel, and it is set in sometime in the future. We've got Gigi and her little brother, Didi. They're living on their own in a desert. And they're living on their own because their mother is working in a place called Oasis City. And you get the feeling that it's some sort of a large complex, maybe it's a factory, but they're kind of living out their days, dealing with sandstorms, having to go scrounge for water, and you know, basically because their mom is trying to build a better life for them and get them a, I don't know if it's a pass or some sort of an entry into Oasis City. And the other thing that I really struck me was that they're trudging like every day through the desert to get to this what looks like a little phone booth so they can have a phone call with mom. So anyway, after a very troubling day, they somehow come across this AI robot, which is actually a half body, and it's kind of semi, it is completely like dead, and they drag it back to, you know, their home. And they work on it a little bit. And the next thing you know, AI robot comes alive. And the thing is that they find this AI robot in like what's considered the dump. And there's like all sorts of brand new stuff in there. It's like, wow, like all this, like people have stuff that they just have so much stuff that they end up throwing it out. But anyway, back to AI robot. They somehow, you know, turn it on, and AI robot is like, "What do you want?" And she's like, "We want a mom." So the robot becomes a mom. AI mom is how the robot becomes known. And as I mentioned, the robot was like a half body. Well, they end up, you know, figuring out going to find the rest of the limbs. It is the strangest, but at the same time, very hopeful book. Because the expressions on these children's faces, they're just so happy that they get this relationship with AI mom. I'm just like, okay, we know AI. This, I guess, because like I feel like every single day I'm like reading something about AI, right? Mm-hmm. And it was just, I don't know, very, very striking. And at one point, the real mom or the biological mom comes back and she's like, "Who are you?" And the kids are like defending AI mom, and it's just like she's been taking care of us. But the art illustration, kind of like Sean Tan, if you follow the work
Absolutely.
Of Sean, the drawings are like not super busy. It's just like a charcoal pencil drawing, very very striking. You would not forget this book if you read it. So I hope you like it.
Wow.
It's interesting. Mm-hmm. It kind of just the niggling thing of Clara and the Sun by Ishiguro. Yeah, Clara's not a mom, but she is a caregiver or companion in a sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
Adds another layer of parental anxiety.
Yes, to, it does.
You know, right? Potential things.
But it's also based on and parents going off to.
Yes.
Yeah. And having, I mean, this story actually is, I don't know if I wouldn't, I don't know if I want to say dedicated, but just like the author, you know, kind of, you know, thinks of the left behind children. And this is in China, where a lot of parents, you know, leave rural areas.
Certainly to work in the cities.
And to work in cities. And actually, I mean, Qiu Jing is Canadian, well, Chinese born, but now lives in Canada and, mm-hmm. you know, writes about a lot of themes that are related to right. families in China.
Right.
Really interesting. Very gifted. And did I write it down? I think it's called The Floating House. That's going to be coming out by Qiu Jing in a few months, a couple months.
Really okay. good.
I'm really excited to read it.
I think that's everything we were going to cover today. It was a very interesting taping. And we will see how it all turns out.
Yeah.
But until then, happy reading.